right, so now you're going to say you don't know where to start. Go ahead.
We're talking about death. I'm going to Oxnard this afternoon to see a musical version of Little Lord Fauntleroy. Now, wouldn't that pass as one of the more absurd things you could think of?
Are your expectations low or high?
Well, my expectations are always low. It's the only way you can be surprised.
I believe in low expectations.
I believe in low expectations, too, because every time I have high ones, I'm always disappointed. And I don't like to be disappointed, generally, especially if I'm paying for it. If I don't pay for it, I don't get so upset.
A musical about Little Lord Fauntleroy.
A musical about Little... in Oxnard. At the Oxnard Performing Arts Center.
A long time, a few years ago, I was in London and I saw the Jerry Springer musical.
Oh, I heard about that. The opera. Wasn't it Jerry Springer?
It's Jerry Springer opera. Yeah, David Soule from Starsky and Hutch played Jerry Springer. And he can't sing. He has released a couple albums. And it was surprisingly amazing. Really,
that doesn't surprise me.
Really great story, twists and turns, and I was really surprised, but it was very pleasurable. Let me introduce the show. Let's get the show officially started. Hello, everybody, and welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is playwright, director, performer, and theater critic, Harvey Purr. All those are correct, right? You've done all those things? Bottle washer, cab driver, short order cook?
I don't even know how to drive a car, let alone
all
a
right.
cab.
We'll hear all about Harvey and his life in a moment, but first a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is Harvey Purr. Hello, sir.
Hello.
You were saying a minute ago that you don't know where to start because you could start anywhere. But I find it's usually interesting to start in the middle.
To start in the middle.
just because there's more middle than anything else, and it just gives you more leeway.
Well, my middle almost has nothing to do with any of the things you called me. The middle of my life, which was the part of my life that got cemented here in L.A., was when I was working in the music business, of all things. I worked at Capitol Records. They needed an underground liaison, and I had been writing for the L.A. Free Press. And so they called me in to do this, and as a result, I got connected with everyone else. And I was at Capitol. And anyway, it was a wonderful time because we were going to the concerts all the time. We saw everyone you could possibly see. We saw Jimi Hendrix open, not only for the Mamas and the Papas, but for Scott McKenzie, who no one ever even remembers. But he had a big hit at the time about California. I don't know, San Francisco.
There was a lot of songs about San Francisco.
But Jimi Hendrix opened it. That was at the Bowl. I mean, and I got to eventually work at Elektra. I got to know Jim Morrison a lot, very well. As a matter of fact, Jim Morrison got me the job because I had written a piece about him in the L.A. Free Press and about a Doors concert, and I started talking about all the different places I had seen Jim Morrison at, like the open, Judith Beck and Judith Malina, the Living Theater. There he was at the Living Theater. He was at a production of one of those Norman, the Deer Park. God, you're going to have to jog my memory. And anyway, I just was impressed by him, and I wrote this piece. And when they published the Morrison Hotel music book, that would, you know, every album had a music book, they included my review. And for a long time, if you looked me up on Google, the first thing that would come up would be my review of that Jim Morrison concert.
So what can you tell us about Jim Morrison the person? A lot has been written about Jim Morrison, you know, the quality of him as a person.
Jim Morrison was he really wanted to be a filmmaker. He was a poet and a filmmaker. Those were really, you know, he wasn't so much interested in the music, I didn't think. I mean, he was making a lot of money, and but he was a very serious guy, I found, and my relationship with him was based almost entirely on talking about film. He was very, very erudite about movies. He had a sense of history. He had a sense, and he made a film called Highway, which I think is actually available on DVD on one of those Doors documentaries.
I'm going to check it out. Highway?
H-I-W-A-Y.
Okay. Film by Jim Morrison. All right, check it out.
That he made at UCLA. I think he made at UCLA.
Now, I mentioned a moment ago that this show is called Comedy Death Star. It's about the dark side of comedy.
Right.
What does that mean to you?
Well, I've always thought the best comedy was also disturbing. I mean, for example, my partner has been trying to become a stand-up comedian, and so I've been watching a lot of stuff. I'm very impressed by a guy named Jim Jeffries, but particularly by a guy named David Cross. Do you know David Cross's work?
Yeah.
Because what I like about him is that he takes his time, and then he becomes the character that he's making fun of, which I think is, one, great acting, and two, a much more interesting way of getting into the truth of something. That's just me. But and Louis C.K., those are my three gods right now.
And what about the discomfort? You said things aren't...
I never watch a Louis C.K. Film without feeling it's too close to the truth. But in a good way. I mean, you know, why do what everyone else does? I think those particular ones I mentioned, they were all white. I shouldn't have done that because I also love Kevin Hart and the really great one, Chris Rock.
Chris Rock.
I should have said that right off the bat. But I guess I identify more with what David Cross is doing because he's coming from a place I'm more familiar with to begin with. And I think he's very serious, and even though he makes me laugh constantly. But if I just were laughing at jokes like Abbott and Costello, I mean, that's okay. But it doesn't have that extra resonance that you would have if you were also being disturbed and if you were also saying, hey, there's something behind the comedy, that he's saying something serious about the life in which we're living.
We have this connection between things that are difficult or painful and laughing at them.
Well, we do. There is a history of that, I suppose. You could even say that terrible Roberto Benigni film about the Holocaust.
Life is Beautiful.
made us able to laugh at one of the most horrific events, at least in my lifetime. But I didn't find it particularly funny, I'm sorry to say.
Well, The Producers is also a comedy about Nazism in its way.
But, you know, that one is rooted in a kind of a vaudeville, burlesque shtick that most Americans do understand, I think. You know, it's different. I find The Producers funnier.
Well, there's just not too many funny things about the Holocaust or about Nazis. I mean,
well, I also love the fact that there's that one line in it about something about being a smarty, join the Nazi party, and every time you hear it, it's always Mel Brooks's voice.
Don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party.
That's it, exactly.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You grew up in Brooklyn,
right?
You spent a lot of time in New York. You came to Los Angeles. You've gone back to New York.
I came to Los Angeles in 1965. In 1965, I was married at the time. I had a one-year-old daughter, and I was working for a trucking company that was in bankruptcy. And I came out here because I had been a member of the Edward Albee Playwrights Unit, and each year they would send two playwrights to what was called a seminar. And the seminar meant you spent a month at Universal and to see if they were interested in you as a writer. And so that was the first time I came out. When I came out that time, I came out alone. And when I came back from the seminar, I got a phone call asking if I was willing to come out on a 7-year contract in which I'd get a raise every 6 months. And I told him, don't hang up. Because I really had no other job. It was like going from, it was like it fell into my lap. And so I moved to L.A. and I worked at Universal for 6 months. And at the end of 6 months, they said, there's nothing productive is happening. So we'll continue with you, but we won't give you the raise. And so I said, well, if you're not going to give me the raise, I want to go home, because I was not enjoying L.A. at all. But of course, as perverse as Hollywood can be, they gave me the raise, and then I worked for 6 months and actually did work and then got fired. So while I was here, I had to go back to my roots, which was as a playwright, mm-hmm. not as a screenwriter, although movies really are my great love. I really regret not having gotten more involved in film. I love film. On the other hand, I don't love Hollywood, so who knows if that would have ever been productive anyway. So I became a playwright in Los Angeles. And when you become a playwright in Los Angeles, when on the East Coast, they kind of look down at you. And what was interesting to me was that there was once an article in the New York Times by a critic named Mel Gusso, in which he talked about the major playwrights in America and literally put me down as a Los Angeles playwright, when in fact I was the only playwright in the entire list who came from New York. Lanford Wilson was from Missouri, and Sam Shepard was from California, I've always had a hard time either living up to that or living down to it. I don't know how you look at it.
But you still get more respect in New York.
They look down at me because I was a Los Angeles playwright.
Oh, I see.
That's not even worth considering. Yeah. He's had a success in Los Angeles. That doesn't mean a thing. And of course, when La Mama sent out two groups of plays, one to Denmark and one to Paris, I got stuck with the one that failed. There was one that succeeded, and they came back, and they did an off-Broadway run, Six from La Mama, and I was back in L.A. Don't ask.
Well, I have a theater question for you.
Yes.
Just because I'm curious. I was reading something, and you said that I think 1955 you saw a production of Waiting for Godot.
In London.
And it really changed things for you, rocked your world.
Where the fuck did you get this information? Anyway.
This is my... I'm a professional.
Your research.
What happened when you saw Waiting
for
Godot?
Well, what happened was I was 17 years old when I went to Europe for the first time in 1955. And, of course, I wanted to see everything that I had known about theater. There was a Terence Rattigan play with Margaret Leighton and Eric Portman. And I wanted to see the stars. And I wanted to see, And somebody said, if you see nothing else, you've got to see Waiting for Godot. And it was an actor named Miles Eason who told me that. And so my friend and I went to see Waiting for Godot. And it was, of course, as you can imagine, being 17, being interested in being a playwright, looking at that play, being in that theater, it was a totally new experience. Now, in the middle of the second act, somebody decided to get up very loudly and said... this is a terrible play. He says, I'm leaving right now. And you can see, at first I thought, this is part of the play. How would you not know? And then the actors looked really confused. And finally, one of the actors said, if you don't like the play, I think you should leave. And he said, well, I am leaving. And if everybody else said what they really felt, they'd be leaving too. And he left, and the play continued. So the whole experience was so intense to me. And there was an actor in it who, Peter Woodthorpe, he is my favorite unrecognized or unknown actor. He played played the Robert Shaw part when they did The Caretaker in the original London production. And he was the one actor who didn't come to New York with it. And he was in that production of Waiting for Godot. And every time I'd go to London and he was in a play, I would go to see it just because... And I associated him forever with Waiting for Godot. I have now seen Waiting for Godot so many goddamn times, including a production that was directed by Beckett, which I didn't think was very good.
Was it noticeably different than productions not directed
by him? It wasn't noticeably different.
Okay. You just didn't like it as much.
No. There have been great productions.
Yeah.
I saw a wonderful production with all women one time.
Really?
But he would not give them the rights to do it.
Yeah.
Just as Edward Albee wouldn't ever give the rights for four gay men to do Virginia Woolf, which is a shame.
Too bad.
Because I saw a wonderful first act at the Actors Studio with Paul Winfield and Clyde Ventura. I'll never forget that. It was so brilliant that everybody said, you must write to Albee and get permission to do this. And, of course, they wrote to Albee, and he said no.
Yeah. Now, I like that kind of... Some people would call that stunt casting in films, but in a play or in anything, if you cast cross-gender or you cast in obviously the opposite way, it adds a lot of texture. It's not just a stunt.
I always thought the Beatles should have done Waiting for Godot.
So tell me more about that.
I just thought, they were the big stars of the time, and there was... The our first avant-garde artist who was making it in a kind of a big way. I thought it would have been interesting. It would have been interesting for the Beatles to handle material like that.
Ringo has to play Lucky.
Of course.
And then, let's see, it's going to
be... Maybe not. No,
he's definitely Lucky.
I would say that... John Lennon would have to be the smarter one, which was the Estragon of Vladimir, which was...
Marginally smarter one, yeah. Anyway.
Yes.
But those two guys are going to be Lennon and McCartney.
Right.
And then
George would be Pozzo. I would cast Paul McCartney as Pozzo and cast George Harrison as the other...
So you have John
and George be the two...
And then you have the other pair is Paul and Ringo.
Yes.
That makes... Yeah, I like it. I like it. Oh, my God. Now I want to see that hard. And is that your favorite play of his? Because it's not my favorite play.
My favorite play of his is Crap's Last Tape.
Oh, my gosh.
It's a play I'd love to do.
That's my favorite play of his as well.
I also do love Endgame.
Yeah.
We did the Taper, of all places, because the Taper, I think, has been... I go back to the Taper at the very beginning.
Which is when?
When they were still at UCLA, mm-hmm. and before they opened at downtown, I just knew Gordon Davidson, and I knew Eddie Perrone, who had directed Over the Lovely War for them at UCLA, because he was the head of the playwrights unit at Barr, Albee, Wilder. Edward Albee's based playwrights unit, which is where I got my start. And anyway, so I was at the very beginning. Edward said, "Well, come be one of the playwrights that joins us." And I met with Gordon. I became closer in many ways to Gordon than I was to Eddie, even though Eddie was my, what do you call that, the person who
mentor.
Brings you to
sponsor, mentor.
It isn't
sugar
quite
daddy.
It wasn't any of those things, but he did direct my very first play.
Edward Albee did.
No. Edward Perrone.
Edward Perrone. Okay.
But Edward Albee was my teacher.
Got it.
And Edward Albee gave these two playwriting classes at Circle in the Square. And out of those two playwriting classes, he took four playwrights who then became the nucleus of the playwrights unit he created with the money he was making from Zoo Story. Not Virginia Woolf. Maybe it was the money he was making from Virginia Woolf. It's conceivable. I don't know. You'd have to look up dates, but it was around 1963.
Okay. Before we get lost in the weeds, I want to hear more of what you have to say about Crap.
About Crap. Okay.
That, to me, that's the top of the pinnacle in the theater, in my personal opinion. So, yeah, what do you want to tell me about
that?
Well,
it's always interesting for me to imagine, because Beckett was fairly young when he wrote it, to imagine your death, in a sense, or imagine your old age, and to imagine that all the things you're doing in your life are absolutely wonderful, and knowing at the time you're doing it, as you look back, that it was all ridiculous. It's always that one particular... Mm-hmm. line that I really like when he comes across the word verduity. Do you remember that? It's like a word you only use when you're young and when you're full of language and, you know, love of language. And then suddenly it hits you. And of course, it's a much more beautiful word than the ones we use, like greenery or whatever.
Right.
You know,
he has to look it up.
Yes,
he has to go back and look it up. And what the heck did I mean? Yeah.
It's one of those moments in the theater that I think one comes to live for, you know.
Well, I think what I love about it is that he records on his birthday every year and has some reflections. And he also then listens to tapes that he's recorded on his birthday in past years.
Right.
And every year he says, what a young idiot I was in the past. So this notion that, you know, at any moment you look back at yourself and think you were stupid, and that you're in the future going to look back at today and think that you were stupid. I love that.
You know, there are certain plays I've seen so many times. I thought that the recent production of Waiting for Godot that they did at the Taper was actually very, I don't know what Beckett would have thought of it, but I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was brilliant because it made them, for the first time, you could also see that these were two old guys who'd been traveling this road together for a long time. Maybe they were even lovers once, you know, fellow vaudevillians or whatever. And they were down on their luck, but they were still kind of moving on in this way. And I thought I was moved. I mean, I've seen it. I love the play. I think it's a great play, but I was truly moved. And I was also, there was a production of Endgame in New York that John Turturro directed and starred in. And John Turturro, I guess you know, the main character is called Ham, H-A-M-M. But John Turturro took it upon himself to say that Ham is a ham actor. Now, given that he chose that, it was fine. It was a fine choice, and he played it brilliantly. But I don't think that's all that Ham is. I mean, you know, and it's kind of like in this last production, Alan Mandel played a man who was old, he had seen it all, and nothing was going to disturb him. Well, that takes a lot of the tension and a lot of the anger out of the play when you do that, it seems to me.
Because it's over for him.
Yeah, because he's not still going on and not still kicking people around, and, you know, and but in this production that John Turturro directed, Nell and Nag were the most memorable characters. They just struck me. They were played by, maybe you don't know these names, but in the theater they're kind of legendary, Elaine Stritch.
Yes.
And Alvin Epstein.
I don't know Alvin, but I know Elaine Stritch.
But, well, you normally she's the last person you would think of to do Samuel Beckett. But she was incredibly acerbic, sharp, but also very moving. Very, because she really was getting on in years.
Yeah. I also like Happy Days.
Happy Days is a great play,
another
too.
Another one. See, he has these moments.
I love those three plays where they're just sitting, their faces are just in the... those urns. What is that one called?
I forget that one.
Why do you? I forgot the title too, because,
well,
it's a great play.
There's a lot of them, but Happy Days is similar.
Rockabye is wonderful too.
She's buried like basically up to her neck.
Yeah,
and she talks and talks.
And her husband is sitting at the bottom of.
But
the
he doesn't pot. Acknowledge he her speaking.
But he doesn't leave her side either.
That's right. But when he finally acknowledges that she's said something by responding to her, that is the moment that breaks things open.
Right.
You know. It's like Godot. They're flipping the coin, flipping the coin, flipping the coin, flipping the coin. At some moment, a thing happens. Mm-hmm. And then life begins. I'll tell you, just before we get off this, my introduction to Godot, there's an old television production of the first act, black and white TV, that stars Burgess Meredith and Zero Mostel.
I saw that.
And that was my introduction. And it I was the same thing. I was like 18 years old. It blew me away. And I said, I gotta see what else is going on here.
Well, you know, the Americans had the right instinct in casting people like Zira Mostel and the one who started it, Bert Lahr, because they had that vaudeville instinct.
Yeah.
You know, it was bigger than life. And all the horrors became twice as horrible because as if they were burdened by them and they didn't know how to fucking deal with them.
Well, if you don't have any of that kind of overinflated or a sense of humor, then the piece becomes dead and boring. And
oh, tell me. I saw Nathan Lane do it recently, and I could hardly sit through the first act.
Too serious.
No, he played it for laughs.
Oh, then that
and therefore the laughs didn't come.
Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Okay, that's wrong. All right, let's switch things up a little bit.
Okay.
I want to ask about this thing that you wrote, which was The War Widow. Mm-hmm. It was 1976 or something, right? It was produced here in Los Angeles.
77, I think.
Yeah. And people are still talking about it because, you know, it's the first television presentation of real lesbian romantic experience.
Yeah.
My question for you really is, why were you interested in this woman's story? And story.
Okay, I'll tell you. What happened was, I came out. I was married, had a child, and then I came out as a gay man. And I basically wanted to tell my story. But the reason I made it about two women instead of two men was I was also interested in doing a period piece. I had been reading a lot of George Eliot and a lot of Jane Austen at the time, and I kind of got into that mood, and I thought, I want to do something like that, but about something that means something to me. But of course, not writing it about myself. I remember when they showed it at the Lesbian Gay Film Festival in San Francisco, that there was a sold-out performance in which there were only two men in the audience, three men in the audience, myself, a friend of mine, and Vito Russo, were the only men in the audience at the first show. But because it was sold out, they had to add a second show, and there were about 12 men. And my instinct was, you know, they were lesbians were pretty advanced in those days. I thought they were going to all say, why didn't it, they probably let a man write it instead of a woman write it because, you know, that's what they do in Hollywood and everything. But I was the one who suggested it. And then when they finally did talk to me, I didn't get any of that response at all. They just seemed to be happy that it was written at all. And at that particular performance, we didn't have video yet. And so many women who had watched that show had taped it. And then they had given it to let their lovers listen to it.
On a Betamax, for example.
Right, or something. And then their lovers would come to the show with them and see it. And it was this wonderful connection that they were connecting through something one of them knew and one of them didn't. And there was the writer in front of them. It was a kind of a wonderful experience. The letters I got from people were wonderful. I got lots of letters from teachers in their 70s who had never come out. And that it had kind of encouraged them to come out as a result of that show. Up until then, the only lesbians you ever saw on TV were bad women. All the more reason I should have written it about men, because men were still getting a bad break at the time.
Stereotypically, in the mid-70s, yeah. No. And so, what are you working on now? You're working on a show.
I'm working on a show. I've been doing this for the past 2 years. You want to know about its genesis and everything?
I don't know. Is that boring or is that interesting? Is it boring or is it... I watched it.
Oh, yeah? What'd you think?
Well, I have some questions about it. One thing that you say repeatedly through is that you're glad you're not young anymore. And
you want to know if that's true?
I want to know if that's true.
It's absolutely true.
On what levels it's true, yeah.
The only level on which it's not true are the aches and the pains and the amount of medications I have to take and not knowing what's going to happen next. That's the only downside of it.
And what's the upside?
The upside is it's been a great life.
So you're glad not to be young anymore.
I'm glad I'm not young anymore. On the other hand, I do regret... You see, my point in that show, if I can say it a little bit more clearly. It's not so much that I'm being sentimental about my past loves and everything, or that I mourn for them or anything. It's kind of like I say it in the beginning, you know, don't give us the bullshit. Don't give us songs like Get Happy and There's Going to Be a Great Day, and don't tell your children everything is going to be wonderful, because it's not. And then I feel what I do is I show how I followed those bullshit lies and lived my life according to them, that there's like no way of avoiding that. That's what the show is basically about to me. And any attempt to make that point clearer, I will listen to. I mean, it's not finished. To me, it's not set in stone yet.
It's a work in progress.
It's definitely a work in progress. But it's a work I've gotten proud of, and it's a work I've persisted in doing. And the very first director I ever worked with, I don't know how interesting this will be to you, is Edward Perone. He ran the Edward Albee Playwrights Unit. He's also the man who discovered Edward Albee in America. He became his agent and brought him to the attention of Richard Barr. And directed his first productions. The first Beckett productions to be directed here in L.A. were directed by Eddie. But I went to Eddie as a friend. Eddie directed my very first play at the Playwrights Unit. And this is now 50 years later, and I'm visiting him in Santa Fe. And I just want to know if he can help me shape it, to talk to me about it. And I did it for him, and he said, I want to direct this. So we got on this thing where he directed, and even though I didn't write a single word of it, as you know, the way Eddie looked at it is, Harvey, you've never written the same play twice. Every play of yours has been totally different, and this is a play. I said, I don't care, you know, you may not have written the words, but you have conceived a play. And so, based on that, I've been working on it, and the performances I gave in L.A. and Berkeley last year, and even recently in Cincinnati, were based on his plan. But he died last January, and so I am actually looking for another director, because I can continue doing it this way, but I'm doing it blind, because I need an eye. I definitely need an eye. And so I'm going to New York in September, and I'm going, I don't want to name names, but I have a champion in New York who at whose place I will definitely do it, in his loft, when there'll be a lot of good people. And my dream is to do it in New York. To me, it's a New York show, and it is about my connection to New York.
The director in New York is not Richard Foreman, is it?
No. Well, I wish it were. Is Richard still alive? I guess he must be.
As far as I know, he is. But you mentioned something and then said, as you know. You haven't written a word of this play?
Not one word.
Because I noticed that there are big sections that are song lyrics that you string together. But I didn't realize that none of it was written by you. What's the source material for
Well, they're all lyrics. There isn't a line in it that isn't a lyric from a song.
This is 70 minutes of... 75 minutes.
Well, no, it's more like 55 minutes.
Is it 55? Okay.
Did it seem like 75 minutes to you?
It's 55 or 60 minutes of a solo theatrical production, and you've not written a word.
Right.
That I'm interested. Tell me why that is.
Well, I've just always felt, when I started out, I thought, you know, there are two things that have played a very important part in my life. One is movies, and one is pop music. And I always thought it would be interesting to take the lyrics of songs and turn them into conversations. And so when I originally started, I had my New York songs, I had my autumn songs, I had my whatever, you know, categories, and I was doing it that way for a while.
So you grouped them along, like, geography or themes?
Yes, first group was all autumn songs, then it was a bunch of New York. I can't tell you how many songs we've discarded before the version you saw, and how many songs we've added along the way. Now that you're getting me to talk about this. Anyway, I did not write a single word. And my notion was I could tell my life story through these lyrics. And so it would also encapsulate the time in which I lived. It's only now that I've done it and I've been doing it that it suddenly occurred to me, but you know, I also lived in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. Why aren't there more songs from now? Even there is one guy who I think is amazing. Do you know Magnetic Fields?
Yes.
He's written an album called 69 Songs. And there are lots of stuff in there that I'd love to find a way to include, because that represents as much my feelings about this as, you know, the songs you do here.
It's a great album.
Oh, I know. I think what is his name again, Rich?
I forget his name, but yeah.
Stephen
something. Merrick?
Stephen Merrick.
Is that right?
Yes.
I wouldn't have gotten Stephen, but since you primed it with that. So that is super interesting to me that you've not written any of that. Do people realize that? I mean, they realize it at certain moments. I hear the audience laughing. They realize, oh, that's you know, I'm Your Man.
Sometimes they recognize the song.
Night and Day. You know,
those are the obvious ones. Yeah. But I feel that what I do with those songs is so totally different from what anybody else has ever. I mean, Night and Day has become like this fucking obsession about you. You know, it's like, oh, fuck. Can I do...
Yeah, sure. We edit.
Hello, I'm in the middle of this interview. Eat now. I'm going to shut the phone off.
Wrong number?
No. It was my partner wanting to know whether he should eat now or wait for me to eat.
So I understand. Now I'm even more interested than I was before. So my question was, do people recognize that the whole thing is song lyrics?
No. A lot of people think that there's a lot of in-between work that I may have written. But they see it as a piece in that that I've made them listen to these lyrics for the first time in a way, in some instances. And I tried to avoid the more obvious songs because then it's too easy for the audience to start singing and not hearing what you're doing.
But you deliver the parts not like the songs at all. You
right. I mean, I have changed the cadences.
Conversational.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it occurs to me, you said, well, what did I think? Now that I know that, I become curious that if you planted some recognizable lyrics in the beginning in a way to let people know that this was a lens that they're looking through, if that would add to their experience of the piece. Because right now people recognize it sometimes. I think you wrote, I did. I thought you wrote parts and I thought you pulled these in at certain moments. And my question was, so what are those moments and, you know, what does that mean to you? But now that I know that it's everything, it really changes how I'm looking at you as a writer and you as a performer,
right,
performing the piece. So I have another layer. So yeah, that popped into my mind. So have you thought of that, or what do you think of that idea? I'm not even sure it's a good idea, so don't worry.
To start with a lyric that is more familiar to begin with.
Well, that's just an example. To have it be obvious to the audience that this is what they're hearing.
Well, I'm certainly open to any idea. And if I were working with you as a director right now and you would say, try this, I would definitely try it. I'm not closed off to anything. I happen to like that opening.
Yeah.
Because you don't know. It's not a familiar song, even though it's written by the very same people who wrote, I guess I'm not young. I'm glad I'm not young anymore. To me, there was a connection. But one is known and one is unknown.
And who wrote those songs?
Frederick Lowe and Alan J. Lerner.
So Lerner and Lowe, yeah. I mean, people know them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yet they don't seem to know Another Autumn. Because it comes from Paint Your Wagon, a show that they don't know as well as they know My Fair Lady or Camelot or...
Well, and we're dealing with the generations of...
Right.
Right, I mean... 30-year-old people today are not going to know any of these things, My Fair Lady.
Oh, and favorite reactions have been from... There was one young African-American man, about 28, who saw it at one of these performances, and he said, I didn't know any of those songs. He said, I just thought you wrote a bunch of poems, he says, but it certainly affected me. It felt like my life. I have an unwritten play in which each scene was punctuated by one of the characters singing the blues, singing famous blues songs, but singing them. I also wrote a play called Gethsemane Springs, which was done at the Taper. And it included a long, long riff on Begin the Beginning. So somehow pop music has been playing a little part in my life throughout. I mean, in Gethsemane Springs, there's even a moment where this woman sings, I got a brand new. It's an Arthur Schwartz song. Anyway, she did this number. So obviously, I have been putting pop music into my shows. This, why this idea came to me, I don't know. I was sitting at the typewriter, at the computer, actually, and I was listening to music. And I was just trying to relate to it. And then I went to a visit of some friends in Berkeley, and I said, look, let me just do this for you. I've got this idea, and I've had 100 ideas in the past 20 years, none of which have worked out or I put away. And I said, but this one, it just seems interesting to me. And I played it for them, and they loved it, and they encouraged me to go on with it, and I did. And then I performed it in that shape, but only for friends. And then it was when I met with Eddie in Santa Fe that it began to really take shape. Then we went to San Francisco to rehearse it. I did it in Berkeley, and then, as you know, I came back after he died to do it his way. The group in Berkeley used that space primarily for concerts, piano concerts, trios, and musical events. And in a sense, this was the first drama event. And since then, and it's only 2 years ago, they've done quite a few.
I'm going to jump around because we're jumping around. There was one last question that I wanted to ask about this show. It's called Harvey Purr, A Life in Words By... ..
When you get the program,
yes,
you will see all the lyricists' names mentioned. I can give you a copy.
So that's why it's capitalized in Words By.
Yes.
So now the words are by. Now I understand the title.
Right.
Here's the question. There's also several places where you suggest that young people have a responsibility to be foolish.
They don't have a responsibility to be foolish, but they have the good luck to be able to be foolish, because it's not considered foolishness. It's considered what you do. You only look back upon it and say, God, we were foolish, but why were we foolish?
Well, now we're back to crap.
Well, yeah. And, there was one point at which Eddie said, we're going to make this like a Beckett monologue using these lyrics. And that idea appealed to me. And when I started, I wasn't so rueful and mournful about a lot of it. But the more I do it, and the closer I come to death, which we do. I'm closer to death now than I am to anything else. But there are times, and Eddie always said, the show will always be different depending on what mood you're in. And I can tell you that most of the time my mood gets more bitter and more regretful.
By doing the show.
When I do the show, I find that even the words I've been saying at other performances have suddenly new meanings for me, are totally different meanings. For example, I've wanted to kick out California, Here I Come. I want to kick out everything that I feel I'm doing by rote. If I do it by rote, it's no good. So I started to think of, if I do California Dreaming, for example, you know, where I want to be in L.A., and I go and I propel myself into L.A., then Lazy Afternoon becomes a totally different song, if you do that. And so I want to play around a little bit more with making changes that will also change the attitude and, I don't know, but that sadness is coming into it, and I can't seem to stop it. I mean, I try to be as light as I can, but it's there, you know. The interesting thing was, when I first suggested Both Sides Now, my director felt it was a little too on the nose.
What song is that? Both Sides Now?
Both Sides Now by Joni Mitchell. It's the very last song of the evening. So that's the one thing I've added since he died. And it just came to me at one rehearsal, I said, walking out and saying, well, we'll catch up some other time. It was a nice way of going off into the sunset. But I needed to make a further statement about, you live through all of that shit, and what does it all mean in the end? What have you really learned? And suddenly it made a great deal of sense to me. And there was even someone who said to me that their first reaction when they heard it is, oh no, not Both Sides Now, that's too obvious. But by the time I had finished it, they felt I had said something different than they had heard before in the song, and that made it worth doing. But you've got that point. If someone says, oh, at the very beginning they don't want to hear it, and they have to be kind of awakened, that might not be a good thing. I don't know. The only way I can do that is to do it over and over again and to find the right timing, instinct.
Are you a spiritual person?
What it is I really am an atheist. I don't believe in anything. I just don't. And but there is something that kind of keeps us going, and I think it's more a moral thing. I consider myself a very not hostile person. I'd like a better world. I find myself at odds with most people I speak to. That's a problem. And not even people my own age agree with me about a lot of things. I mean, you know, I have family members who I think they came from another planet, not from the same family, but I'm sure everyone feels that way.
Another couple last questions.
The many last questions.
As a child, did you have an imaginary friend?
No. But I went to the movies an awful lot when I was a kid. An awful lot. As a matter of fact, you know, when they didn't know what to do with me, they just dumped me into a movie house. And the people in the movie house knew me, because I would never go to the bathroom in the middle of a film. I would never make noise. I could sit there for 5 hours through a double feature, cartoons and everything. And I just loved movies. So if I had a dream, if I had an imaginary life, it was that I imagined making all these movies in my head. That's why I say movies are important, and I don't know why I didn't get into them, but...
Why the hell you became a playwright?
Right, I became a playwright instead. Well, I know why, because language is also important to me. And the thing about film is it's not so much the language as it is what you're seeing. Yeah. So I have a kind of a better visual sense, but yet I'm in love with language. Really complex. I was born at the right time and place, I think, for that. If I had been born 20 years later, I think I'd be in film and not in theater.
It would have been easy to,
Not easy. It costs a lot of money to make movies. You know, as expensive as theater is, it's still cheaper.
Yeah. You don't know this. I have this thing that I do in the world, which is that I have given friends and family permission to hit me in the face with a pie or squirt seltzer at any time, essentially because it makes other people happy. To be able to do that to me, and that's great. Usually when a pie is thrown, it's thrown aggressively. But I've removed that because now I'm accepting this pie with love and generosity. And it really changes the whole dynamic. And so my question for you
is, yet.
is if you were going to receive a pie with love and generosity from anyone that you've known or anyone in history, who would you want to throw the pie at you?
Who would I want to throw the pie at me?
And again, you're going to receive this pie with love and generosity and a great spirit.
That's a really interesting question. I would like my daughter to throw the pie at me. Because even with generosity, there'd be something else behind it. I could easily say my partner because it would be done with love and I would love tasting whatever the pie was made of. But something else would be coming from my daughter which would be more interesting to me.
What do you think would be coming from her?
It wouldn't. It would have all the fun and generosity elements, but it would all, there'd also be anger. There'd also be, I want to throw a pie in your face.
So you think she would throw it at you with some anger?
With some anger, yeah. Not a lot, but with enough. I wouldn't know until it happened, but I think I could tell.
And you would want to take that anger?
Yeah, I wouldn't mind that at all. So one thing I feel is missing between me and my daughter. Is that, you know, we too much of the time we say, why worry about what happened in the past? It's what's happening now. We have a great relationship. Why worry about it? But I do worry about it.
And you would like to hear more of her anger?
I would like to hear more of her
You'd
anger.
You'd be open for her expressing that to you. Yeah.
Well, that was coming out of nowhere. I thought you were going to say, who would I like to... that you were asking me to throw a pie in your face or something.
Well, you could in the future. Since now you're in the friends and family circle. So for you to... I would encourage you to give this gift to other people. Give the gift to your sister, to your daughter, for example. Tell her, hey, if you ever want to do this, let me know. Open season.
Okay.
And see if that's interesting and useful to her. Give the gift that keeps on giving. Give your family what they really want this year for Christmas.
I must have a very trivial mind because all this brings back to me, was it The Great Race? Is that the name of the movie?
Yeah,
they just throw pies at each other just willy-nilly until it becomes just this.
Well, I was reading an article recently about in Dr. Strangelove, you know, which you've seen, obviously, Kubrick had shot a massive pie fight at the end in the war room. And then he decided that it pushed it too far into farce, and he was trying to keep this delicate balance between farce and seriousness. And the pie fight was just too much.
He took it far enough into farce. Well, I don't know if it needed less the pies in the face, but
well, he cut it out. He cut it out of the film, or he didn't put it in the film. What else? Anything? What do you want to say? You want to say anything? You got anything bugging you that? You need to get off your chest?
No, I don't know. If you could ask me questions for 24 hours and I'd be able to answer all of them, but I can't think of, off the top of my head what's important to me. I think I've mentioned it to you. I mean, I'm outside of telling you details of my real life, my autobiography, but I am very proud of the fact, very proud of this cousin. Joey Purr is amazing. His sister's amazing too, but Joey is particularly amazing. And his parents kind of, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't say this. I always felt that his father was afraid that he might be gay. And so he thought, well, what better thing to do than to create role models for him like Harvey and John? Because they're the gay couple I know, and they're wonderful people. And so he allowed us to become his mentor. And, of course, he isn't gay. But he has a great relationship with us, and he's always coming to us for advice. He was even calling John, my partner, up about romantic advice about this girl he met. And anyway, and he's writing this book about his family. that I think is amazing. And he's just recently sent me these things back that I said. And I, you know, if I were writing about my own life, I'm not so sure those were the things that would have come into my head. So I have to give him credit for asking the right questions and for getting that out of me. But it's been really interesting. And I think, you know, my life is not uninteresting. Yeah, I mean, people whose lives are always good, I don't envy them. I think they're full of shit.
Here's the last question. I believe that all of us, most of us, have a superpower.
Telling the truth, as I see it, of course. And not caring if the person you're telling it to is going to be upset by it. I've lost a lot of friends that way. But on the other hand, I've made great friends that way. And I think the great friends I've made outweigh the ones I lost.
Well, Harvey, I would love to thank you for being on the show. You've been listening to Harvey Purr on Comedy Death Star. If you would like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you may email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. So far, no one has called or emailed asking for a Comedy Death Star coffee mug. So you can also...
That's all you have to do is ask for it?
Well,
and how much does it cost?
Oh, I don't know, $10. But I'm not going to make any money. I'm going to send it to one of those places that, you know, make the things, custom stuff, and I'll just send it to you. It's not a revenue generator. It's just for fun. Dylan Vigil is our producer and engineer. Our theme music was written and performed by my pal in San Francisco, Dean Mermel. You have been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week. Thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.